Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
My name is Hilda. I'm an alcoholic. 7 o'clock on a Friday. I reckon the only people we have here are the dedicated or the desperate. Only you know where you are. Let's see. Thank you, Ralph, for asking. Always good to see Candace and a lot of friends here. It's funny, I was talking to somebody earlier about unlucky drinkers. And I really think I was an unlucky drinker, you know? So the thing that struck me, this fellow was saying, oh, he was so unlucky, all these things happen. And the one thing that sticks out in my mind that really sums up how unlucky a drinker I am, it was early, I was in college, and I was on the East Coast, and they've got those really old, beautiful architecture buildings, and they have massive drain pipes outside. And I was in the bathroom when this party was happening, and it got raided. And I thought, brilliant. I'm only on the second floor. So I went out the window, and I'm shimmying down the drain pipe, right? But the things that hold it to the wall have these big nails that stick out. So as I'm going down, my bra is getting caught, right? So I'm going down, and I'm trying to, and I get to the ground, and I think, whew, made it. I turned around, and two coppers were looking at me, and I was topless. And he looks at me and he goes, were you at the party? And I went, no. Nope. That's my luck drinking, you know. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous because you get that, right? Non-alcoholics go, really? You went out the window? Oh, so I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Cool, let's see. I was born in London, which will save you wondering. I grew up in a pub. It was my grandparents' pub, and I'm an only child and an only grandchild, and only children like myself are really good at entertaining ourselves. For me, my playground was a cellar, and I loved it. I loved it. You know, the bottles became my playthings, and I'd line up the whiskey bottles on one side and the vodka bottles on the other, and I'd have the whiskey bottles chatting to the vodka bottles, and they'd be chatting to me, and I'd be chatting to them, and, you know, whiskey was the bad guys, and vodka was the good guys. And the only sad part about that is it was still happening in my 20s, but I loved everything about booze long before I ever drank it. You know, I liked the colors and the fancy labels, and my granddad's pub was in the shape of a U, and there were two pubs on the street with a little hallway between them, and out the back was a long bar, and then an alleyway between the long bar and the kitchen. And my bedroom was above the kitchen, and it looked straight down into the long bar. You know, now, the other two bars, one of them was a cocktail bar, which people went to after work. They'd have a couple of drinks and go home. And the other one was the front bar, because it was in the front. It's called the front bar. But that's where, like, older people would sit and drink a brandy all day. One brandy all day. And even when I was little, neither of those were attractive to me. But the long bar had life. You know, it had life. It had pool tournaments and dart tournaments, and fights would break out, and the police would come. And from my bedroom window, it was magic. It was just better than telly. I loved it. And one night, I snuck down after hours. They had this thing in London called lock-in. And after normal hours, the locals got to stay, the regulars, and they'd get locked in. And my granddad would let them drink until he went to bed. And I snuck down this one night, and I didn't know how old I was, but I poked my head around a corner, and my granddad flagged me in. My pajamas still had feet in them, you know. But he put me up on a bar stool, and he gave me a baby sham. And at the time, Baby Sham had this, it was a little bottle, and it had this cartoon deer for its logo that was kind of leaping, you know. And my granddad put it in a little glass, and I was a little person, and I just thought it arrived, you know what I mean? And to this day, I can't tell you if I got tipsy or I got drunk or if I liked the taste or didn't like the taste. I have no clue. I just know that that night I got to be one of them. You know, I got to be one of them. I got to be one of. And I love it when people talk about the effect produced by alcohol, like our book talks about. For a lot of people, that is being numb or being tuned out or whatever. The effect produced by alcohol that I went for was to feel part of rather than apart from. And alcohol did that for me. It made me feel like it was okay for me to hang out with you. So the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about me. It's around page 33, and I'm paraphrasing very badly, but it basically says, it doesn't matter what you drink or how often you drink, it's what happens when you drink, and that many who are merely potential alcoholics often become the real thing in a relatively short amount of time, particularly true of women. And I'm one of those women. You know, by 16, I had an ulcer. At 17, I got done for drunk driving. At 18, I had a heart attack, and 6 months later, I was in my first mental hospital. And that's when drink was working, right? It all went downhill after that, you know. Over the next 3 years, I was in and out of 5 mental hospitals. The longest I was ever out of a mental hospital was for 2 weeks. And in those 2 weeks, I got my own flat, I had the curtains drawn and the answering machine on and a fridge full of Asti Spumante, vodka, and Michelob Light, because I'm a calorie counter too. And for those 2 weeks, I did not see or speak to another human being, and I was happy. I have a clear memory of standing in the shower, drinking a cold Mic Light, not knowing if it's day or night, not caring. And thinking it just doesn't get any better than this, right? But what happened was I got a knock on the door one day, and it was my mom, my shrink, 2 policemen, 2 nurses, and they shot me in the arse with something and put me in a jacket with really long arms. And I came to at the Institute for the Living in Hartford, Connecticut. And I thought... I was on candid camera, I'd been punked or something, right? Because it seemed a little surreal to me, because they told me I had been committed for a minimum of a year for being a danger to myself and others. Now, I hadn't seen anybody for 2 weeks. I was like, who are the others? And it really bothered me, you know, because people in those places are crazy. And now... I have always known that I'm not quite right, that I'm just not quite, just a bubble off normal, not quite. I don't think I've ever been a full ticket. I don't think I'm ever going to be a full ticket. And quite honestly, I do not believe there is a program in the world that will make me a full ticket. What I do know is that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the tools that allow me to act as if I'm a full ticket. And I am running with that today, but... So I knew there was something wrong. I knew they didn't know what it was. But my roommate, it was really obvious what was wrong with her, right? I mean, she had rage attacks. 1 minute she'd be fine, and then she'd snap, and she'd start punching out windows and going for nurses. It'd be chaos. All these nurses would come in. They'd tackle her to the floor. They'd wrap her in cold, wet sheets, and they would toddle her away. Now, she had something I didn't have, and that was friends locally. And her friends used to smuggle money in all the time, so our room always had money hidden in it. So when she got toddled away, I'd start thinking, because I'm a thinker, you know. Thinking, really shouldn't leave all that money just sitting around, you know. Somebody should do something with it. So I went AWOL on her dime. And first time I went AWOL, I had $50 on me. I had no clue what I was going to do, and I ended up in downtown Hartford. And this little fellow wandered up to me and he said, "Psst, do you want to buy a ticket to Prince?" Now, I did not know who Prince was. I am truly an AC/DC Black Sabbath kind of girl. But I was thinking a dark auditorium, this might work, right? So I get these tickets, I smuggle in two bottles of vodka, I'm sitting in the nosebleed seats, and while he does his little raspberry beret thing, I got absolutely legless. And after the concert, I was wandering around Hartford, and I ended up in the park, and there was a group of fellas passing a bottle around, and I sat down with them. And they never said a word. They just kept looking at me like stupid or crazy. But they let me drink with them. And as dawn came, the white van with the blue letters pulled up, Institute for the Living. And I stood up and said, I gotta go, my ride's here. And these guys just looked at each other like, yep, crazy. So I get back to the hospital and I have to build up my little trust points, and anybody who's been through that knows what I'm talking about. And as time was going, I wasn't going as far, and one of the last times I went AWOL, I ended up in this pizza joint around the corner from the hospital. And I thought to myself, now Hilda, this time we are going to do this like a lady. We're going to do this properly. So I go into this pizza joint, I order a slice of pizza and two pitchers of beer. I sit down in the booth and I start pouring it in the glass, because we're going to do this like a lady. But just as I get started, the nurses from my unit came in on their break. So now I'm down in the booth with the pitcher up to my mouth, trying to get as much down me as I can before they see me, you know. It's just madness, madness. So as my year was coming up, I had to go before a board of psychiatrists. And my psychiatrist stood up and said, Hilda will never live in normal society. She is completely incapable. And his recommendation was that I did a minimum of another year. So it took me 2.5 months to convince the board to let me out. So I did 14 and a half months. And in hindsight, I think he may have had a point. Because I got out, I moved from Hartford to Hamden, which was just down the road. I got a little job, I met a fella, and he turned out to be a coke dealer. And I had never done coke. I did not know that it would let you drink longer, right? Those of you nodding obviously did. I did not. But I'll tell you what happened in a relatively short amount of time. I have this job at $700 a week. I have a coke habit of $1,500 a week. And when you do the math, it wasn't coming out terribly well. And I was sitting on the counter in my kitchen one day. I was drinking McLight at the time, and I looked out at my flat and realized I had sold everything, including my curtains, for coke. And I thought, Hilda, if you are hanging out with people who will buy your curtains, we have a problem here. Do you know, I never did coke again. In fact, I'd be in parties and people around me would be doing coke and my head would go, mm-mm-mm, remember the curtains. Now, I think that's what makes me a real alcoholic, because far worse things happen to me drinking than ever happened to me with coke. And never once did my head ever say, don't drink. What it might say is, stay away from the red wine because it makes you cry. Don't be drinking the whiskey because it makes you mean. Or my version of chapter 3, switching from scotch to brandy, or Scott to Randy. But it never actually said, don't drink, right? So I'm in Hamden, I get done for drunk driving, drunk and disorderly, indecent exposure, and I think, you know, I never should have left England. It was so much better. What was I thinking? And I'd move back to England, and I wouldn't be in England very long, and I get done for drunk driving, drunk and disorderly, indecent exposure, and I think, you know, America was so much better. What was I thinking? And really, that's my drinking in a nutshell. It was always going to be better somewhere else. And everywhere I went, there I was. And I have a long list of arrests for indecent exposure. And I know I don't look the type today. Maybe a little. But something happens when you add alcohol to my type of alcoholic. And I know I'm not alone in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I have heard plenty of women share. But as soon as you add alcohol to my type of alcoholic, for whatever reason, I just know that you have to see my tits. Now, I tried everything for that not to be true. And I know that it's part of my alcoholism, because I do not feel the need to show them to you now, right? I just don't. So I'm back and forth and back and forth, and I'm back in England this time, and I'm tending bar with my mate Andy. Andy and I have been great friends for a long time, and Andy's birthday was on New Year's Eve, so we started drinking on Christmas Eve, as you do. Now, I have always been a blackout drinker. I used to call it losing time. I was always losing time. I might lose a couple hours, I might lose a couple of days, but I was always losing time. Now, I had assumed that when I had lost time, I had passed out quietly somewhere. I found out on the 3rd of January that was not true. So Andy called me and he asked me if I was ready to pick out rings. And I had no clue what he was talking about. And he said, no, Hilda, not this time. Now, he brought over a video. I am on this video. And I look great. I look great. I am not slurring my words. I am not walking funny. I drink in hand. It was all these different pubs we were in. All my friends were there. My father was there. I'm watching this video, and Andy went down on one knee, and I thought, dear God, say no. Because I wasn't there. And it was the first time I realized that you didn't know that I didn't know that I wasn't there, right? So I did what I did best, really. I went to the pub. And I found the guy in the pub that knows everything about everything, right? This guy is in every bar all over the world. You know, he's the type, you ask the time, and he tells you exactly how the pendulum clock really works, right? Truly the most interesting man in the world, right? So I'm telling him, poor old me, I don't know what to do. I'm engaged, and he said, did you know that if you volunteer on a kibbutz in Israel, they give you 3 meals a day, they do your laundry, and you get 50 quid a month. And I thought, result. 3 days later, I'm in Golders Green, I got a visa, I'm going to Israel. Now, I'm a good Irish Catholic girl. This all made sense to me. So I went to Israel. I went for 3 months, I stayed 9, and I come out of a blackout in Tel Aviv, charged with drunk driving. And I didn't remember renting the car. And I can tell you that really horrible things happen to young, vulnerable women who drink like I do in places like that. And I got out on bail, and I jumped bail, and I went to Egypt, and I ended up with the wrong people in the wrong place at the wrong time. And really horrible things happen to young, vulnerable women who drink like I do in places like that. And I ended up getting dumped in Cairo, just near the American embassy. I had a beat-up T-shirt on me, a pair of shorts, and not another thing to my name. And a big American Marine took pity on me. It was Ramadan and everything was shut, including the embassy. And him and his mates looked after me until the embassy opened. Now, I can tell you, I truly believe a non-alcoholic woman who had been through what I had been through would probably never drink again. But I'm a goalpost drinker. I'm one of those drinkers that says, if it gets bad, I move the goalpost back just a little bit. And if it gets worse, I just move the goalpost back just a little bit more. You know, I got an emergency passport. I wasn't 20 minutes in the air. I thought, hell, they could have killed me. I was drunk when I landed. I had no clue that it was alcoholism. I didn't know what was happening. And the whole 80s for me are a bit like the Talking Heads song, Once in a Lifetime, where he goes, this is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife. How did I get here? It's like one big blackout with little bits of reality tossed in. And coming to the end of the 80s, I found out I was in a relationship that apparently I had been in for quite a while. And my partner was commenting on my drinking, which I just thought was rude. So I moved to Nebraska. Moved in with me mom. And I wasn't with me mom very long, and she started commenting on my drinking. And I really didn't know what to do. And I thought about my uncle. Now, my uncle had tried to 12-step me when I was 18 in a pub in St. Albans. And he was buying the beer, so I let him talk. You know, he was on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said to me, did you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you need never drink again? I was 18. I thought, why wouldn't I want to drink? But he could see where I was going, and fast forward, it's all gone horribly wrong. And I thought about him, because he was still sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was what I thought a real alcoholic was, right? I mean, my uncle went to prison. I only ever went to jail, right? My uncle went to detox centers. I only ever went to mental hospitals. So in my mind, he was what a real alcoholic was. But I thought I'd give it a go. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on New Year's Eve, 1989. I picked New Year's Eve because I truly believed that no real alcoholic would quit drinking on New Year's Eve. I know today only alcoholics mark the calendar. Non-alcoholics don't do that. Non-alcoholics don't think about their drinking. And they certainly don't put little red X's on calendars. You know, it's like virgins don't go for pregnancy tests. It doesn't happen, right? But I didn't know that, right? So I'm in this meeting, and they're talking about he's the father, we're the children, and I thought I was screwed. Because that can't be the answer, right? I mean, I'm a seeker. Israel, please, right? I can't hear anything else in the meeting, so I started taking everybody's inventory by their shoes. Because I can't look at you either. And the fella sitting next to me had on the biggest pair of cowboy boots I'd ever seen. And I thought, I wonder if his IQ is any bigger than his boot size, right? Tearing these people to shreds. And after the meeting, I made a beeline for my car, and this big, dumb cowboy followed me out. And he said to me, have you got a big book? I said, of course I have a big book. Doesn't everybody have a big book? Now, I wouldn't have known a big book if you had beat me to death with it. But I couldn't tell him that. But without missing a beat, he went to his truck, and he gave me his big book. And it was the first time anybody had seen straight through me. And I was speechless. And this little old woman ran up to me and said, did you know if you go to a lot of meetings and you don't drink in between, you can't get drunk? I was like, thank you. I got in my car and I thought, these people are freaks. But something happened when I pulled out of the car park. That little woman's voice resonated in my head and I thought, hang on a minute, she may have a point here. If I went to a lot of meetings and I didn't drink in between, I might stay out of trouble. That's what was attractive to me. That's exactly what I did. I went to a lot of meetings, I didn't drink in between, and my life took off. I was a rocket to stardom in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you have any time in here at all, you know who I'm talking about, right? I look good, I sound good, I'm dry clean only clothes, I've got a nice car, my jobs are getting better. I mean, problem is that I'm coming 5 minutes late, leaving 5 minutes early, calling it a home group, right? I am sitting in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, dying of alcoholism, and I didn't know. I didn't know. And I had got this woman to sponsor me because people were giving me a hard time about not having one. You know what they're like. So I found the oldest, frailest woman I could find because I thought she wouldn't give me a hard time. It doesn't work. But she really tried. She really did. She tried a lot with me. And when I was about 3 years sober, dry, she got really ill and she was dying in hospital. And I went to see her and she said to me, just remember, Hilda, Alcoholics Anonymous will be here for you when you come back. I hadn't drank yet. I had no clue what she was talking about. But she could see exactly where I was going. And of course, she passed away and I pulled away. I went from 7 meetings a week to 5, to 4, to 3, to a week, to a month, because now I'm busy. I'm not going to Wednesday night because I can't stand the secretary. I'm not going to Friday night because the same woman shares the same shite every week and I can't listen to her anymore, right? So now I'm taking AA's inventory. So I'm in Florida. I'm on my way to my dream job in Germany, a job I had worked very hard to get. Well, I lied very hard to get. And but I was on my way, and my partner had come back because I wasn't drinking. And we're walking on the beach, and she turned to me one day and said, you know what, Hilda, not only do I not like you, I don't love you drunk or sober. And I thought, are you kidding? 3.5 years I haven't had a drink for you, which was my utter problem. So I took my now ex to the airport, and as the plane took off, I walked in the bar. I started with double Jack, because that's how I drink. I started drinking on the Thursday. I arrived in Germany on the Sunday. I started my new job on the Monday, got done for drunk driving on the Friday, and woke up in a wet bed next to my new boss on Saturday morning. That's my drinking. Glamour drinking. I drank like that for 9 months. And the morning after what I hope was my last night before I woke up in my own bed, which had become a bonus. I was alone, which was a bigger bonus. But the bed was wet, and I was still dressed from work, and this is all normal for me. But I went into the bathroom, and my hose were all ripped. There was blood everywhere. I had a great gash in my face, and I had no clue what had happened the night before. And I had a moment. You know, I heard people in Alcoholics Anonymous share about the hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I think, God, you're so dramatic. That morning, I knew what you were talking about, and my heart broke. Not because I can't drink anymore. I drink with the best of them. But that morning, I realized I could no longer drink safely. I did not care when I was unpredictable to you. But that morning, I realized I had become unpredictable to me. And I did the only thing I knew what to do. I called English-speaking AA. And a fella called Steve Baker answered the phone. And I told him my sad old story. Poor old me. Wine, wine, wine. Been to Alcoholics Anonymous, screwed it up. He said something to me I truly believe saved my life. He said, you know, Hilda, the most natural thing in the world for an alcoholic to do is drink. And that's why in Alcoholics Anonymous we do not shoot our wounded. And I believed him. It's the only reason I went to a meeting that night was because I thought he understood. So I'm driving over to this meeting in Honsbrook, Holland, and my head kicks in. My head goes, hang on a minute, Hilda. I don't want anybody to think we're new, right? I don't want anybody to think we don't know what's going on in here. So I'm thinking about the meetings in Florida, the really big meetings, and my thought was I would come in, sit in the back, get a little bit of time, and then tell you what happened. But what happened was I walked into this meeting in Honsbrook Hall, and there were 7 people in the room for an hour and a half. And nobody was letting me pass, right? So I told all them my sad old story. I mean, it wasn't hard to see who the newcomer was, right? They're all shiny and new. I'm sweated, bloaty, gash in my face, you know, the vision for you. And so I shared honestly, and after the meeting, they were looking for somebody to make the tea and coffee. And I was thinking, wow, I hope they find someone, you know. It's an important commitment. And this voice from across the room went, Hilda will do it. And I was like, Hilda who? This meeting was Tuesday, Thursdays, and Saturdays. This was Tuesday night. I was like, hang on a minute. I didn't know if I'm going to be sober on Thursday. That seemed like a long time for me. And this woman just looked at me and said, if you want to stay sober, you'll make the tea and coffee. Now, my head went, who is this psycho bitch, and why is she tormenting me? But my mouth went, oh, okay. You know? I had no fight left. I was done. And, you know, if you're new, I really hope you're tired. I would have done anything that woman suggested, and I tried, because I just didn't know what else to do. And I didn't know if it was a Thursday or the Saturday, but one of the nights she pulled me over and said, you know, Hilda, I think you really should try and do 90 meetings in 90 days. I said, do you see where we are? Honsbrook, Holland. It is nowhere. Hang a left. She goes, oh, I know where we are. You know, they have a meeting in Dusseldorf on Friday night, and Dahan on Monday night, and Kaiserslautern on Wednesday night. I was like, hang on, I am not driving all over God's Acre for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not happening. She goes, huh, how far did you drive for a drink? Which is so unfair. Because I am that drunk at 2 in the morning driving around for anything open, right? So I started tormenting my home group. On Thursday night, I'd say, I'm driving to Dusseldorf tomorrow. Does anybody want to go? The guy I hated the most. Hated. Always went, I'll go with you, Hilda. I was like, anybody but you. But Mike would show up every Friday night, and we would drive an hour and a half to Dusseldorf for an hour and a half's meeting, for an hour's coffee afterwards, and an hour and a half's drive home. And I wanted to kill him the entire time. I have left skid marks on the Autobahn where I pulled over to tell him to get out. But he was like 8 years sober, and he would just laugh.
we're going to be late if you don't get going.
I am so grateful for where I got sober. I'm not sure I could have done it anywhere else because I learned, you know, in small town AA, you learn principles before personalities. You have to when you hate your entire home group and they're all you've got, right? So I was reading something one night and I didn't even know what I was reading, but it prompted me to call the psycho woman. And it was like 2 in the morning. And I called her, and she answered like she was waiting for it. It's creepy when that happens, right? And I said, Sandy, I'm reading this bit in the book, and I think I need a sponsor. Would you sponsor me? She said, I have been, but thanks for making it official. That's how I got my sponsor. But I tell you what, she was good as gold. Good as gold. She had the patience of a saint with me. We were in her kitchen one day, and we're reading the book. And she took me through the book page by page, line by line. When there was an action, we took it, and the way I like to do it today with others. And we're reading the book, and she was in the kitchen, and I was at the table, and I said, I know what it says, Sandy, but do you know what it means? And before I could enlighten her, her book came across the kitchen and just missed my head. And I was like, Sandy, what are you doing? She goes, no. When you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we read the black bits. There's nothing in between. What they say is what they mean. And of course, I'm a mumbler. I'm like, I don't think so. I think there's more to it than that. Patience of a saint. So I was at her house one night, and I was just about to go home, and I said, you know what, Sandy? I am wasting your time and mine, because I always drink. I'm a drunk. We're wasting time here. And she said, you know, Hilda, if you really apply steps 6 and 7 in your life, practical application, you will no longer have the excuse of I've always been and I'm always going to be. She said, you don't get the excuse anymore because you can change. And she gave me hope. Today it's my experience, but I'm so grateful for that moment, you know. And I was about 9 months sober and my company promoted me. They were sending me to Belgium. Belgium. I thought it was just a place on the news. I didn't know people lived there, you know. It's one of those countries you can carpet border to border and have bits left over. And I was so depressed. I was doing duvet therapy. I know nobody here has ever done duvet therapy. It's when you get home from work, you get under the duvet, you get up the next day and hope it all changed. It doesn't work, but I didn't drink. And finally, I called Sandy, and I told her what was going on, and she told me to blow the dust off my big book and get my happy little arse 20 minutes up the road to the Brussels meeting. It was every night of the week. And she said, when you get there, I want you to share honestly. I was like, whatever. So I drive up to Brussels, and I go to this meeting, and they had almost no literature. Their coffee was like sludge. So when I shared, I told them so. And afterwards, they gave me the literature commitment and took me to coffee. And I learned about putting my hand out. And I was about 14 months sober when I got offered a job in London. And I did it all different. I went over every weekend. I had a home group there before I moved. I had a service commitment waiting for me before I moved. And people in London AA helped me find a flat. And it was the first time I'd ever done something different to get a different result. I heard you talk about it, but I'd never actually tried it. And I didn't have to do duvet therapy. And I was tootling along and London AA and ended up in a relationship, which I'm still in today, go figure. But we went to Ireland, to the All-Ireland Convention. And I heard this speaker say, you can do absolutely anything in Alcoholics Anonymous if you're willing to do the work and pay the price. And I was like, huh. So I went back to London, I quit me job, I went on the dole, and I started applying to universities. I'm going to go into a helping profession. Going to help people. 2.5 years sober, I did not know myself well enough to know that I don't like people enough to do that. But I didn't know that then. So I was 4 years sober when I got into university. Hard to do in London. And got my first tattoo and my first motorcycle. And 4.5 years sober, I had a motorcycle accident. So I got a bigger bike and a bigger tattoo. 5 years sober, I started my second year at university, and I thought, nobody was surprised, and I thought that was because they believed in me. And what I found out was it's because they believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, because you can do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous if you're willing to do the work and pay the price. So I'm tootling along quite nicely in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm at school, and I'm working, and I got my motorcycle, and I'm in a relationship. My life is good. And I was on my way to a convention in the south of England, and just before I left, the phone rang. And it was my mom. And my mom was living out in Pasadena, and she had been diagnosed with breast cancer. And she asked me if I would go out to California when she had her operations. And of course, I said I would. Now, I had spent my entire sobriety to that point asking my sponsor, how do I ever make amends to my mother, right? I am an only child. I tore my mother's heart out. I called my mother collect from foreign jails, and she could do nothing. My sponsor says, if you're sitting here with us tonight, there are 10 people digesting their dinner better, 10 people sleeping better because you're here with us. I have to tell you, my mom is one of the 10. And my sponsor kept saying, it's God's time, not yours, and when the time is right, you'll know. So when she asked me to go out to Pasadena for these big operations, I went. And I made sure I was there when she woke up, and I was there when she went to sleep. And the old 202 Club in Pasadena was right across the street from the hospital, and when she was sleeping, I ran across. And they say, is it odd or is it God? Right? Oddly. Because of what I had been doing at university, I got to take my mom home early and nurse her at home, right? And when I was emptying my mom's tube, she just turned to me and said, you know what, Hilda, I don't know how I'll ever repay you. I said, you don't get it. 6.5 years I waited for this moment, when I get to be the daughter you deserved instead of the one you had. My mom and I have a great relationship today. You know, I love that thing, life is not measured by the number of breaths you take, but by the moments that take your breath away. Because that's been my sobriety. It hasn't been the years. It's been those moments, you know. And my mom's in remission. Sometimes I forget to let you know she's still here. In fact, she's retired now. And she's retired now. She has a lot of time on her hands. You know, she called me not that long ago and said, I'm getting the internet delivered. I said, no, you're not. We're going into a whole new thing here. she just turned 75, and we had a little surprise party for her. And I talked to her a couple of times in the week, and she was like, wow, I can't believe I'm going to be 75. That's a big number. I said, yeah, it sure is, Mom. I don't know what I'm going to do for it. I go, yeah, it's a big one. You should really think about doing something, you know. And then Julie even, you know, texted her, and my mom texted one word back, fine, right? I was starting to feel bad, you know. But when she came and we gave her this nice little surprise, and I leaned over to her and I said, did you think we forgot? And she said, I know you don't forget these days. That's Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. For her 60th birthday, she wanted to go back to Ireland. So I said I would take her. And I told my sponsor, I'm taking my mom back to Ireland for her 60th birthday. My sponsor said, just remember, this is your mother's trip. I said, yeah, I know. She goes, no, really. This is your mother's trip. I go, yeah, I get it. So I took my mom to Ireland for 10 days, and she showed me where she went to school and where she bought her sweets and where she caught the bus, and I wanted to kill myself. But I remembered it was my mother's trip. And I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in Ireland, and you reminded me it was my mother's trip. And she loved it. She loved it. And golly, I guess it was 2001. We were living in London, and we decided we'd come live in California. So we came on a 5-year plan. We stayed 7, as you do. And Southern California AA completely changed my entire sobriety. My entire sobriety. In fact, the sponsor I have today, I have never been busier in Alcoholics Anonymous, and her bar is still higher than I can ever get to. And I love that. And in 2008, we had to go back to Ireland because my partner had visa problems. So we went back to Ireland for a year. And I did not get on well in Ireland. But I'm well trained in Alcoholics Anonymous, the product of strong sponsorship. I call my sponsor every day. I called her every day from Ireland. And finally I said, look, Sharon, I don't know what to do. And she said, I think it's time you get on an effing plane. I hung up the phone and Julie said, what did Sharon say? I said, she told me to get on an effing plane. She said, do you want to lift to the airport? Because we knew we'd work it out. Alcoholics Anonymous. Came back to Southern California. I was 15 and a half years sober, jobless, penniless, sleeping on my mom's floor. Not where I wanted to be at 15 and a half years sobriety. And it was dark, and I couldn't get a job, and I didn't know what to do. And I called my sponsor, and I said, oh, geez, I don't know what to do. And Sharon said, hang on a minute. Aren't you and your mom watching certain television shows every week together? I said, well, yeah. She goes, aren't you having dinner a couple of times a week together? I said, well, yeah. She goes, don't you think this is another way to make amends to your mother by allowing her to be a mother? I hadn't thought of it that way. Of course, Julie got back in the country, and I got a job, and we got better jobs, and we got an apartment, and we got nice cars, and life took off. And in 2011, the company I was working for was going under. So I called my mom, and I said, Mom, the company's going under. I'm going to be out of work. My mom went, you can come live with me. It took my mother 24 hours to realize I had given her bad news. She called me the next day. Oh, I'm really sorry about your job. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. So in 2012, I was up for two jobs at the same time. One was with unmanned drones for the military, and the other was with the Spirit of Giving. Now, if you have had more than a 10-minute conversation with me, you know I am an unmanned drones for the military kind of girl. My sponsor, who is an ex-bong wine drinking hippie, said, I really think the Spirit of Giving would be good for you. So I said, why don't we leave it up to God? She said, I think that's a great idea. She goes, here's the deal, Hilda. You have to take whoever offers you the job first. Fine. So I ended up working for the Spirit of Giving. They had slides from the second floor to the first and Barefoot Fridays. It was an adjustment. So, but they had this thing called One Day Without Shoes. So from the time you get up in the morning to the time you go to bed, you don't wear any shoes. Now, I grew up in London. We do not wear Birkenstocks or flip-flops, right? I have a whole thing about my feet, just not big on showing you my feet. I don't even think I have a pair of open-toed shoes, right? And some of the people that I worked with knew I was a little quirky about my feet. So they said, why don't you get a pedicure so that you feel a little better about it all, you know? Now, I've never had a pedicure. And I thought, I'll give it a go, right? So I sneak out at lunchtime the day before, and I go to this pedicure place, and I go in, I say, I wonder if I can get a pedicure. And the woman goes, pick a color! I'm picking a color, right? Because I picked red, because it was a color. And I'm sitting there, and they put my feet in the hot water, and I thought, oh, this isn't so bad, right? And they start putting my hands in the hot water. I'm like, hang on a minute, we're just doing the feet, we're not doing the hands, why are the hands in the water? The hands are in the water. And then somebody else comes over and goes, you want a massage? I'm like, no, just stop touching me. Right? It was not relaxing for me. And I did the whole one day without shoes, and I was chatting with one of my sponsees, and I said, this whole pedicure thing. And she goes, wait, you went for a pedicure? I said, yeah. She goes, oh, and you didn't tell me? I would have gone with you. I said, I thought to myself, how lovely is that, that my sponsee would want to support me? She goes, oh, no, I was going for the show. There's love for you. And one of the other things this company did was on your year anniversary and every 2 years after, you went to a third world country and we got to put shoes on little kids' feet. And I went to Honduras and I was unplugged for 10 days, which is unheard of for me. And every morning I got up, we got in the van and we went to these remote areas in Honduras and we got to give these kids little shoes. And we were in this part of Honduras where the kids are direct descendants of the Mayans and the government doesn't acknowledge them. So their school had no electricity and very little running water and happiest kids you'll ever meet. Now, we had a medic with us because these kids run around without shoes and their feet get all tore up. And I had this little fella and his feet were a mess and the medic took him away and he started to cry because he didn't think he was going to get his shoes. And my heart cracked open just a little bit because I am not that gal. And as we were packing up, I saw the little fella in the valley with his new shoes in his hands, giving me a wave. And my heart cracked open just a little bit more, because I am not that gal. And of course, the point is, I almost missed it. I almost missed it. I am the product of strong sponsorship. Take a direction from a woman I respect, but I do not always like. To do things that rarely make sense. So, in 2016, they had a big reorg, and I lost my job. It wasn't personal, it was just business, and I've been working long enough to know how this works, right? So I had my little box of stuff, and I was leaving, and as I was leaving, my team, who were all very young, were coming in from lunch, and they saw me with my little box, and they got all upset. And I explained to them that it's just business, it's fine, you know. And they were really worried. And I got in the car and I called my sponsor and I said, you know, I just lost my job. And I told her all about, you know, my team coming in and how I really hoped they were going to be okay. And she goes, wow, how amazing is that, that you care so much about your team? What growth, Hilda. I was like, did you miss the part where I lost my job? But it was different this time, right? Because I'd been here before. I knew it was going to be okay, and I treated it almost like a holiday. In fact, we went to Ireland for 3 weeks, and at one point, Julius looked at me and said, you know, I think this is the first time we've been home that you haven't had to look at your phone every 2 minutes for your email, right? And towards the, I guess, the middle of 2016, I started interviewing with this company up in Vancouver, Canada. I am going to Canada, right? Big job, big title, big money. Going to Canada. I was all excited. I'd been up and down quite a few times for interviews, and it was kind of a big deal. And my sponsor, I was chatting to her one day, and she said, you know, you really should keep interviewing locally. I was like, but I'm going to Canada. She goes, I get it, Hilda, but you need to keep interviewing locally. Like, all right, fine, you know. So I interviewed with this little company in Long Beach, and they were really nice people, nice company. I'm driving home, and I thought, but I'm going to Canada, right? And they asked me back for another interview. It's like, fine, you know, but I already know where I'm living in Vancouver. So after this second interview, I'm driving home, and they called me and offered me the job, and they offered me more money than I had asked for, which had never happened in my entire career. And I was like, I'm going to Canada. So I called my sponsor before I gave them an answer. And I said, you know, this little company in Long Beach has offered me the job, but I'm going to Canada. And she said, huh, did they offer you the job in Canada? I said, well, not yet. But they offered you the job in Long Beach, right? I said, well, yeah. She goes, goodbye, Hilda. So I work in Long Beach. And, so I had to call the gal in Canada and thank her for everything and that I had taken this other job. And, you know, I said, you know, I really appreciate it. And she called me back and she said, you know, I told the CEO your position and he'd really like to talk to you because he'd like to change your mind. And without even thinking, what I said to her was, if he could change my mind, I'm not the kind of employee he wants. Because I have a little bit of integrity today. You know, this is principles in all my affairs. You know, what good are principles if they're only applied when it's convenient, right? She didn't get it at all. She was super impressed. It's funny. But I tell you what, it's a good job and I'm enjoying it. Right? I almost missed it. And I have a bit of time, and I was thinking for my 50th birthday, my dad had passed away on his 50th birthday, so for my 50th birthday, I decided to jump out of an airplane, a perfectly good one. And so I went skydiving, and my sponsor went with me and five of my sponsees, and we jumped out of an airplane. And you know, it's I'm not saying that if you stay sober you get to jump out of an airplane or that you have to when you turn 50. But those are the kind of things I sat on bar stools saying, I'm going to do that one day. I get to do it today, you know. And it was magic. And so my dad is buried in Arlington National Cemetery. And he died when I was quite, I think I was 20. And my dad was a really good guy. He was a really good guy. And he came to visit me once when I was in Connecticut. And I was working, went to this Christmas party for work, and it was an open bar, right? An open bar. And I was drinking Black Russians. And I got absolutely legless. And my boss was mortified, right? Because I'm underage, it's her party, and it was all bad. So she called my father to come get me. And my dad was a big guy. And when he came in, I could hear my boss still apologizing. You know, my dad literally threw me over his shoulder, because he's a big guy. And as he turned around, he said to my boss, I wouldn't worry about it. It's not the first time Hilda fought the Russians and lost. Because he knew, you know. And, you know, when I buried him, I was a train wreck and an embarrassment. And, you know, there's a lot of ceremony that goes on in Arlington National Cemetery when they bury somebody, and it was all bad. And when I was going back to Washington, D.C. for a work conference, my sponsor said, I think it's time. I think you need to go make some graveside amends. Now, if I'm honest with you, I would hear people stand at podiums and talk about making graveside amends, and I think, what a load of bollocks that is, right? I didn't believe in it at all. I couldn't see the point. I didn't understand how that would work. But my sponsor asked me to do it. So I'll give it a go, right? I'll give anything a go once. So now, when he died, they had given me this family pass, that I didn't know how important it was. And I've been all over the world, drunk and sober. But when we went to Washington, D.C., we put our hands straight on it. I'm not quite sure how something like that happens. And we rented a car in D.C., and when we went into Arlington National Cemetery, we put this little pass in the windshield. I didn't know that it was a tourist attraction. I didn't know that without this little piece of paper, you can't drive in, right? So we had this little piece of paper, and as we drove up to the gate, the guards at the gate came to attention and saluted. I wasn't ready for it. I didn't know. And I went to my dad's grave, and, you know, we found it right away, which was odd in itself. And I was standing at my dad's grave, and I realized something. I realized that my dad would be proud of me today. Not because I've been sober this long, not because I've been of service or been of service to my mother, not because I got my bachelor's or my master's or that I'm in a healthy relationship or a good job. None of that would have mattered. The only thing my father would have cared about is that I got a little bit of grace and dignity today. That's all he ever wanted. And I have to tell you, I'm a great believer in graveside amends. I didn't know it was going to happen, you know. The truth is, I came to you a lying bedwetting whore. I did not qualify for the third tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to stay out of wet beds with ugly people. Somewhere along the way, you have turned me into a good friend, a loving and monogamous wife, and a true daughter to my mother. For that, I thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.